Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Karen Brooks Hopkins, President Emerita of BAM, or the Brooklyn Academy of Music, was known for saying around the office, quote, BAM is not a job, but a crusade. For more than 30 years, she worked her way up the organization and became intimately involved in the everyday running of BAM, the fundraising, the visionary programming, the events, the galas, eventually transforming the more than 150-year-old BAM into a staple of the arts in New York City. But what does it take to thrive in the New York City nonprofit arts world? As Karen will tell you in her new memoir, BAM and Then It Hit Me, it's not easy. But with the long hours, rejections, and financial stress, there are some highlights along the way, like the time BAM hosted the Princess of Wales, Princess Diana, to see the Welsh National Opera perform in Brooklyn. With me now to talk about that story, the memoir, and a whole lot more is Karen Brooks Hopkins. Karen, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Allison. It's great to be here. Thank you so much.
Let's talk about your young Karen. You're making your way to New York City. You go for an interview for a job at BAM, and the man interviewing, who we'll discuss in a moment, said he needed someone who would work like hell, and you said, I'm your gal. Who was that?
And that was it. Yes.
Who was that? And tell me about that moment.
So at that moment, first of all, I would say that, you know, growing up in Baltimore, Maryland, and being a theater kid, the first time I came to New York, I knew at that very moment that New York City was my spiritual home and that I was going to live here. So as time went on, and I actually got this interview at BAM with Harvey Lichtenstein, who was then president and executive producer and a very formidable impresario, I sat in his office. It was very large. It was a little scary. And that's when he said to me, I need someone who can work like hell, in that really gravelly voice of his. I said, I'm your gal. We shook hands. He sent me down to Junior's, the famous Junior's, to have a slice of the cheesecake. Exactly. And to meet the chairman of the finance committee. And that was it. I was hired. I moved to New York, moved to Brooklyn, and I've never looked back. That was my life.
I want to talk about some of the pivotal moments in BAM's history. In the 80s, BAM begins to make moves with the Next Wave series. How and when did this start?
What happened was we had lost so much money on this program called the BAM Theater Company that Harvey really was focused on. It was a repertory theater program. He loved the idea of it. It was more like the British system, where a number of actors are engaged in a series of plays for the entire season. The only problem is that we didn't have, I mean, when you do something like this, you kind of need 3 years' worth of money in advance so that you can afford to be wrong. Harvey did not have 3 months' worth of money to do this. This was him, you know. He did wildly amazing things, and sometimes they were brilliant, and other times they completely crashed. So the BAM Theater Company crashed, and we needed a real signature. And he himself had come out of the Black Mountain College experience. He had come out of, he was a dancer, and he had come out of work with Merce Cunningham. He hadn't danced with him, but he was a great admirer of his. He knew the avant-garde scene. So at that moment, he decided to really embrace what he loved, and that was experimental, edgy work. And that gave us a brand. It gave us a niche. We couldn't be really a second-rate Lincoln Center. We didn't even have enough money to think about that. So we decided to be a first-rate BAM. And that meant finding our own path. And that path was this attitude that was about being on the edge, taking risks. And the Next Wave Festival was born. And it was, unlike the BAM Theater Company, it was an immediate success. We had remarkable people coming for all different kinds of events, featuring artists like Philip Glass, Laurie Anderson, Robert Wilson, Bill T. Jones. They were the avant-garde stars of the day, and BAM became their home.
My guest is Karen Brooks Hopkins. We're talking about her memoir, BAM, and Then It Hit Me. So when you think about the challenges that were unique to BAM while you were president, What were they that were specifically unique to BAM?
Well, you had two significant things going on. First of all, there was always the money. You know, it was never easy. We didn't have that kind of wealth in Brooklyn, especially at that time. There was a lot of discussion and some serious Brooklyn jokes about coming over the Brooklyn Bridge. People would say, where is such and such an event playing? And the other person would answer, it's at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, but then it'll be in London. And then the other person would say, okay, I'll see it in London. This was the resistance to going over that bridge. Now, of course, all of that has changed. And I would say to people that gave me a hard time about Brooklyn, I'd say, if you want to see your kids, you're coming to my neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And it became largely through the arts as the initial impetus for change. I think that the arts really powered Brand Brooklyn. So focusing on Brooklyn was a real challenge in the job, getting people from all over the world to come and be there. This is always a concern of a president. Finding the money to do it is another concern. And of course, first and foremost, you've got to make sure you have the great shows. So we looked for a formula that was really blockbusters and discoveries. If you give people things that they know and that they know are great, and then you encourage them to see other things that they will discover that are great, then you start to build a really loyal, connected audience. And hopefully that audience will also support the institution.
Once you were in the position to do so, what was something you knew you would change or alter?
The key thing was, you know, when Harvey was there, he had to deal with, you know, these large empty theaters and the borough being in a very kind of, it was a difficult time in New York, you know, the 80s, the 70s. I mean, he came to New York he came to BAM in 1967. So he really had to think about great show, great show, great show in order to draw people over. By the time we got there and were running the place, we thought about great institution, great institution. So it became a different mindset than the way that he dealt with it. But there was also the issue of making sure that we reached out to the entire community. One night, I went to a town hall kind of meeting, and I stood at the back, and I heard BAM referred to by one of the people there as a quote-unquote plantation. This was devastating to me, and I felt ashamed. And I vowed at that moment that we would change that. And we went to work. We massively increased the diversity, not only of the programs, but of the staff, of the board, of leadership at all different levels, and of course in the audience. And that was a real focus of my time at BAM. And obviously the institution has continued to be very committed to all of the racial diversity and ethnic diversity that exists in the borough, which is massive. I mean, this is Brooklyn, you know. Mm-hmm. Everyone is there. That was a key focus, yeah. And one that I'm proud that I believe that we, you know, you can always do better, but I believe that we moved the needle on that issue.
When you think about BAM's role in changing that neighborhood, because it is very different than what it was, how do you think about that role?
I think that the arts should lead. And really what you have now is a cultural district, the Brooklyn Cultural District. And the idea of a neighborhood that is powered by the arts, to me, is one of the great ways for communities all over the country and all over the world to revitalize, refresh, and re-energize themselves. So really, this district has nine core institutions right kind of in the BAM zone, right around BAM. And then there are 55 additional arts organizations right in the surrounding area. You have BRIC on the northern border of the district that has a 250-seat theater. And you have the Barclays Center with 18,000 seats on the southern border. So those blocks in between are a center of incredible power, firepower for the arts. And our goal was to create a district that complemented the energy of 21st century New York City, where you would have institutions small and large, ethnically and racially diverse, visual and performing arts, all bumped up next to each other, not separate, not in the manner of large performing arts centers from the 50s and 60s that were more built off the street, focused on classical work. This, as I say, it was 21st century, and the energy there would reflect the city as it is. And that was our goal.
And I do have to say out loud, though, Barclays was controversial for the people who lived in the neighborhood.
God.
Yes, we have to say that out loud and acknowledge that. My guest is Karen Brooks.
But it's, look how well it's turned out, though. I mean, the Barclays Center is so popular and successful, and it had to find its way into the fabric of Brooklyn.
My guest is Karen Brooks Hopkins, President Emerita of the Brooklyn Academy of Music. You are very honest in the book about one of your worst days. And it revolved around fundraising. It was after the financial crash, and you were having one of your, as all institutions like WNYC do, we have these big events with donors. And you're very frank about it in the book that you got on stage and you thanked a very big bank. And because of the makeup of the crowd, you were booed. What did you learn from that experience?
I learned that you really had to take the circumstances, not just of your own gala, into consideration. You know, I thought about BAM from the moment I woke up in the morning until I went to sleep at night, and I had a piece of paper and pencil next to my bed so I would write things down even while I was sleeping. But you, in order to really be the best leader you can be, you can't just think about your own circumstances. You have to think about the circumstances in the world. And I realized from being booed off the stage in my own theater that one night, and it being such a horrible experience, that I had not considered what many people in the audience might have been feeling. And I considered thanking the bank that was our sponsor. I considered welcoming and acknowledging the gala guests, many of whom came because of the bank. But I did not consider that the larger audience in the house that night might not feel the same way. So I learned a big lesson, and it was a painful one.
In the book, you write, "Every day I would get up at 6 a.m., make coffee, read the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, so I had some sense of who was gaining and losing money, who was making and not making art on any given day, who was alive, who died and left money. After morning exercise, I'd get dressed, perform my daily ritual of looking in the mirror, clenching my fist and saying, 'Good morning, Karen. Today you will raise $1 million. Pick up the heavy bag containing last night's reading, and then go to work.'" So you did that for every day.
For 36 years, Allison, do you think I'm a crazy person? Yes.
I think you're a driven human. So serious question, what does a driven human like that do after you retire?
It was a major transition. I had personal things that were sort of shattering, and then of course it was very hard for me to separate from BAM. But like all driven people, you find your next quest. I was very fortunate that both the Mellon Foundation offered me the opportunity to be their first inaugural senior fellow in residence. And there I was really able to pursue these ideas about building creative, inclusive, arts-driven neighborhoods. And I worked on a research project that allowed me to explore that in an in-depth way, which was an incredible post-BAM opportunity. And I was also invited to be senior advisor and board member at the Onassis Foundation, where I still am involved today in both of those roles. And there, not only did I have the opportunity to go to Greece on a regular basis, which is like, you know, the best not retirement gig of all time, I got to do a lot of projects like our podcast, Live from Mount Olympus, where we take Greek myths. It's on the PRX platform, in fact. We take Greek myths.
We had Andre on the show. We covered that.
Exactly.
Podcast.
You had Andre, yes.
Andre DeShields.
Julie Burstein has been, yes, Andre DeShields is our star, Hermes, and Julie Burstein is the creator and showrunner for the podcast, and we've taken the great canon of Greek myths and turned them into, you know, dramatic form podcasts. So that's been another great project, and I have so many different projects now that while I don't have the same stress on the fundraising side that I had at BAM, I'm really just as busy. And now, of course, I want to promote the book and be out there on a book tour and really talk about all of my experiences at BAM for the 36 years. So I'm still a pretty busy gal.
It sounds like it. Quickly, what is something that people don't understand about the nonprofit world? If you can tell me in about a minute.
The arts inspire love of learning. They build community. Our greatest treasures and our most iconic buildings are our arts buildings. The arts bring people together. And finally, at the end of the day, the only thing that endures from generation to generation to generation are the arts. Therefore, I think everyone should get involved. I think people should contribute. I think we should invest. I think that New York City is the capital of the arts in the world, and we need to all participate in order to revive the city and bring it back.
Karen Brooks Hopkins' memoir is called BAM, and Then It Hit Me. It is out February 8th, and the book can be pre-ordered via Powerhouse Bookstores. Karen, thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Thank you, Allison. Thank you. Bye-bye.
And that is all of it for this hour. I'm Allison Stewart. I'll meet you right back here after the news.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.